to another episode of Shadow Talk, Digital Shadow's weekly cyber threat intelligence and information security podcast. My name is Chris, and I'm delighted to be back after quite a few weeks off, actually, mostly focusing on kind of other taskings, but I have had some leave as well. And it's really good to be back in the London office with my dear colleague and friend, Stefano. How are you doing, mate?
Hello. Nice to be back in the office. Nice to be back on this side of the pod, and good to have you back. I'm really glad that you enjoyed your holidays. It's the best part of working. And yeah, glad to have you here.
Thank you. We managed to avoid all of the rail strikes and somehow managed to get down from the north of England to here today. So yeah, really good. And hoping I don't get stranded tomorrow. But if I do, never mind. I'm sure we'll get back eventually. But one of those things.
At some point, you will be back.
Yeah, it's fine.
No pressure.
And we're also delighted to be joined by Kim, who is not with us today. So we're quite sad about that fact, but she's able to join us today on Zoom. So hi, Kim, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, sad I'm not in the office with you, but actually it's a bit of a tight squeeze when there's three of you in the booth. So this is probably working out best for everyone. That's
absolutely true. What's the record for people on the pod in here? Is it like four or five maybe?
I think
five. Oh no, four? Good. I don't know.
That's before.
Yeah, four or five. Stats, right? So four.
Okay, there we go. Well, that's enough. There's two of us here right now and I'm feeling claustrophobic, but there we go. So we have an interesting week, a week's podcast ahead of us, some really, really interesting stories and things in the world of CTI that have happened. Most notably, starting with the ALF V ransomware group, who have adopted a new strategy to force victims into paying its ransom, essentially by publishing victims' data on the clear web to increase the pressure on its victims. Publishing data online, of course, will make the data indexable by search engines, which does increase the potential impact on the victims due to the public availability of the stolen data. So the first question I have for you both is, you know, what do you think about this? Do you think it would be a successful tactic for ALF V?
Well, it's definitely an interesting development in the whole ransomware landscape. We've seen ransomware groups trying to pressure victims into paying in a lot of creative, innovative ways in the past 2 years, I'd say, from Facebook advertisement to cold calling the victims and just like trying to pressure them to pay, sorry. And so this is just like another step in this way. The idea of doing that in the clear web rather than the dark web, it's quite interesting just because like navigating the dark web is complicated. And even for professionals that work in the sector, there are like endemic problems with infrastructure that doesn't allow you to navigate it like in a straightforward way. On the clear web, you can do that. And a lot more people can access that data. But at the same time, you are more at risk of takedowns and that sort of visibility that ransomware groups always fear in a way because of law enforcement activity and so on and so forth. But in terms of whether it will be a successful tactic for this threat group, it depends. It depends on what the result will be from this attempt, which from what we've seen, they're just like trying this tactic to see if it works and if it's better than the old one. But I guess, yeah, definitely put more pressure on the victim. And there is a bigger chance of the people that get their data leaked to have that exposed and realize that they have got the data exposed, because that's something that doesn't always happen with ransomware.
Yeah, I saw this and I noticed that there was the option for users to actually search for their own, I think their email address or like their names in the actual data set itself, which probably will lead to a number of people in this affected company, you know, their employees are going to be searching on this, right, if it's on the clear web, which they wouldn't be able to do if it was hosted on like an Onion site. Yeah. And I suppose in a way it makes it easier for the threat actor as well, because when they're posting on the dark web on kind of Onion sites, there are restrictions on the speed and how quickly can upload things and stuff of that nature. But I imagine as well, there's risks as well. You know, what kind of risk do you think there is to the threat actor in doing this approach?
Stefano mentioned it just briefly there, that in the clear or in the dark web, there aren't so many regulations and restrictions on or one registering domains. I think, you know, they registered a domain in the organization's name or similar name. So if they're going to do that for every organization, then products like ours at Digital Shadows would flag that as an impersonating domain. And then there would be, you know, protocols put in place to be able to take down that domain. Also, to register a domain, you need to provide details. So I would wonder if they decide to do this for more and more victims, are they going to slip up and not privacy protect one of their domains, or, you know, put a correct email address in, or register it from their IP address rather than a VPN? Like, it leaves them open to OPSEC errors or OOPSEX. I haven't said that on the pod before. OOPSEX.
How does it feel?
That was good. Yeah. Enjoyed it. But then, you know, there are all the advantages that Stefano mentioned as well. So it's going to be a risk versus reward approach for them. And like you said, if the details are being indexed on the Clear Web, then if you're one of the people like me that regularly Googles their email address to see what's out there, you might not even know that the breach is there, or even be looking in the data set itself and just doing your regular hygiene checks and there it is. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether they do this with more victims.
Yeah, the OPSEC stuff, you know, is a really key factor in this, isn't it? Because we know that these ransomware groups do make these sorts of mistakes, like obviously what we've talked about in great detail in the past, like Conti leaks and all of the problems that they had, all of the security researchers, and I imagine law enforcement kind of crawling all over their infrastructure. And you know for a fact that there will be a slip up if they're using this sort of technique. So, yeah, we'll have to wait and see if other groups indeed actually, you know, commit to doing the same sort of technique. A bit of a diversion on the questioning, but how do you actually foresee the ransomware scene changing in the next 12 months? So obviously you mentioned a few of the things like calling business partners, using DDoS attacks to force them to negotiating tables. Any other changes you kind of foresee in the next 12 months or in the short term?
Well, I think the most of the changes that will happen to the ransomware landscape in the next year or so will be likely tied to what happens on the Russia-Ukraine war side. Because the development on that area will definitely have repercussions, like significant repercussions on everything else, including cybercrime. So if you remember, like at the beginning of the year, when we were talking about like what will happen in 2022 in terms of ransomware development and all that kind of stuff, we talked about, you know, external inputs like, you know, international corporations. The US at the end of 2021 was taking a much firmer stance on the fight against ransomware with task force and all that kind of stuff. And everything right now has sort of gone into the, you know, has been a little bit deprioritized because, of course, what is happening right now on the border, on the eastern border of Europe, is more important. And every discussion with Russia, for example, that before was centered on cybercrime, maybe, now it's just focused on the war. So I'd say development on that side will impact the ransomware landscape the most, also because we know that a lot of cybercrime actors, including ransomware operators, at least operate from that side of the war. May not be Russia, but like former Soviet Union countries. So yeah, it depends on what happens there. Hopefully we'll get to a peaceful situation in the next 12 months, but we don't know.
Yes, I would like to hope so as well, but I'm not hanging my hat on that at the moment. It's pretty horrible what's going on, but yeah, a lot does ride on exactly what's happening on the ground and what happens over the negotiating table between Russia and Ukraine. Kim, any thoughts from you on the ransomware landscape in the future?
Well, I have a pretty poor grasp on how much time has passed generally, but then when I was thinking about it earlier, you know, double extortion has been around now for 18 months, 24 months. So I don't think in the next 12, we're going to see it go anywhere. It's just these extra tactics that they employ to try and pressurize victims into paying more. I think we might also see more groups doing the kind of publicity stunts that Lockbit have been seen to do. Like, I think those have been quite successful for that group, because I haven't seen any more kind of come out about them being linked with Evil Corp since they did their whole publicity stunt with Mandiant. I think things like that, just continuing on that kind of professional business model and trying to keep their reputation as good as possible. I read that Alfie give 90% of ransom payments to their affiliates, which I think is one of the highest I've seen. Yep. That is clearly the way that they're trying to lure affiliates in from other ransomware as a service programs. So there might be more competition within groups to try and get affiliates to one certain group, and that might be through ransom percentages, or maybe they'll start doing like other bonus packages like legitimate organizations do.
Benefits.
Yeah. Sick pay, health insurance.
There's only a small a finite pool of kind of skilled ransomware actors, right? So they're all kind of scrambling for these highly skilled individuals, and like you say, they are financially motivated, so they're going to jump ship if they get a better offer to go work for another group, I guess. You know, particularly when if they don't, you know, make their identity known to the actual group they're working with, at least a real identity.
Or like, what's to stop them working for more than one group?
Which I bet a lot of them do.
Yeah.
Especially. Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, you kind of have in your head that they work for one group and that's it, but actually they're probably all mixing all over the place, depending on which leak site is working, depending on which malware is operating the best, at what accesses they've got. Like, there's probably a lot of mix and matching going on.
I think that the change I was going to mention is just, as we know, learn more about these groups and kind of the personalities that are working with them, I think we'll find out that the intricacies and the ecosystem of the ransomware group is a lot smaller than you actually think, because we think of them as like these distinct groups and they're completely separate, but actually they're highly connected in terms of the people they're using or the techniques or perhaps the malware they're using. We all know that they are interconnected, but I don't think we have too good an appreciation for that at the moment. You're just talking about Alfie. I think, are they linked to, is it DarkSide and Black Matter? I think every group's probably linked to those two, but just the de facto answer I go to. But
I was going to say, like, in the past, we've seen a lot of these groups like rebranding or merging or separating into two different entities. So yeah, at some point, these affiliates have all worked for one or the other of these ones.
We might need to, Kim, to do a redo of that graphic, that useful graphic I got from you last year with all the rebranding of the groups. That was quite useful for presentations I've done for a while, but it is a little bit old. So let's move on to another side of the cyber criminal scene, and that's carding. So a new carding service has been established, which is making attempts to distinguish themselves by using a few innovative techniques with regards to the credit card info that it holds. The platform is called Biden Cash, which I guess follows on from the trend of other forums and services of this type, kind of being named after presidents. So I'm thinking that Trump's Dumps, is that the right one? I think it's called that, right?
It sounds good. I don't remember, but it sounds good.
I was literally telling my son about that the other day. I was like, there was a president called President Trump. He thought it was the most hilarious thing ever. But but apparently this site, Biden Cash, was set up at the end of April, but it kept its offerings to the lower level because its infrastructure was not ready to accommodate large-scale operations, but it does seem to be an emerging player in the scene. So the first question I'd like to set to you both is, before we get on to Biden Cash specifically, what to you does carding refer to with regards to kind of cyber criminal activity and things of that nature?
Carding is essentially the process of taking stolen financial information and making it available for sale to other individuals. So that's what we mean by carding websites. And then people that buy card details from those websites will typically use it for money laundering purposes. So by buying goods and then they'll resell them when they receive them, and or other kind of financial frauds. So it's buying cards for a really low amount, like 0.1 of a dollar sometimes, and then being able to use the funds that are on that card to further your criminal enterprise. Did I miss anything, Steph?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, as Kim said, like, you just buy or like trade this information, financial information. It is usually accompanied with, I don't know, personally identifiable information, like your name and surname, your email address, social security number in some instances. And it really, like, when the data is complete, it really gives the threat actor like a wide array of potential malicious activities to conduct further, which can be, yeah, buying and selling gift cards, for example, or cryptocurrency, that, you know, all these kind of steps to, yeah, as Kim was saying, obfuscate a little bit your activity and make the money you get from those credit cards that you just bought or stolen a little bit, yeah, more difficult to trace for law enforcement and for the people that get their data stolen.
I guess the anonymity, I can't believe I just pronounced that correctly. It's usually a word it's can't get. The anonymity is the key thing for the actors here, isn't it? It's making sure that they separate themselves from that fraudulent activity, you know, with whatever they conduct.
Yeah.
But for me, I guess carding is like the atypical, you think of a cyber criminal there, what are they doing? It's financial motivation and kind of stealing your credit card information, going and using it for their own purchases or whatever they fancy for it. What sets Biden Cash apart from the kind of multitude of other carding platforms?
Well, it depends, because like I was looking at the post that the administrator of the site published like on cybercriminal forums to sponsor this platform. And it was interesting because they said, you know, the usual thing that you would say, so like, oh, it's a user-friendly interface, the credit cards get refreshed all the time. It's all those like marketing and PR thingy. But it's interesting because like when you look at the platform, it really seems easy to use. It's got like filters where you can see, you know, you can search for credit cards that are from Italy or France that are expiring in 2 years, 1 year. Like, you got all these kind of filters that really sort of personalize the way collectors can buy credit cards, because usually this data is sold like on big databases. So you buy like a big chunk of these credit cards, where 99% of them are usually old or expired or have already been blocked in that kind of way. So it is new and is getting marketed at least in an interesting way. So there is the potential for cyber criminals to get closer to this platform and see if it works correctly. But at the same time, we're already seeing like some users saying that, yeah, the credit card in there are not the newest one you can get. The usual stuff. Yeah. So it's cheap and it's got some good options. We just need to see whether it will, you know, gain traction among the cyber criminal community.
Yeah, I guess that's the main thing, isn't it? They have to be current. They have to be usable. Yeah. If they're from years ago and the owner of that credit card has actually turned it off in that time, which you would imagine they would have, then those tranches of financial data is going to be completely useless to whoever's buying them, even if they are a fraction of a pound or a penny, whatever you said. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to be current and they have to be useful. Is carding, in your opinion, a major problem? You know, how easy is carding to achieve from a cyber criminal's perspective?
I think it's an easy thing to do. Malware like Magecart, for example, is made to scrape payment information from card terminals or from websites where you put your card details in. So in that respect, it's quite low level, but in terms of impact, like, it's a major problem for the banks that issue these cards. Because it's theft, and especially if it's like credit cards, they're going to be the ones that have to pay that money back to the end users. And then also for individuals who have their information stolen, it's a big is a big deal for them as well. But I think the abundance of these carding sites and the fact that new services like Bide and Cash are having to come up with inventive marketing strategies just to get criminals to go to their site rather than another one shows how easy it is for criminals to collect that kind of information and then to sell it on.
Any thoughts from you on this one, Steph? Would you do this if you were a cyber criminal, or would you prefer to do ransomware? Especially would make more money that
I
way,
would
right?
go with the ransomware.
Yeah, me too.
If I were a cyber criminal, which I'm not.
Disclaimer.
And if I had the technical sophistication to conduct ransomware, which I haven't either, I'd probably go for that one. Yeah, because it looks like the more lucrative one. I think when we were talking with the specialist from our Russian cybercrime team in the last few days, we were discussing this point, like carding, yes, it is easy in a way, it is like widely available, but it's not as popular as it was maybe a few years ago. And that's because, yeah, I think right now there are much more lucrative opportunities for cybercriminals that really put in time and the study to get to the good stuff, you know?
Yeah, I guess the risk to reward is lower for carding, isn't there? There's more opportunity, I guess, to get caught. You know, if you're doing this multiple times, if you make an OPSEC mistake we referred to earlier, you know, you transfer money to the wrong account, or you know, don't cover your tracks enough, I guess. So I suppose it's the realm of I would imagine, a lower skilled cyber criminal.
And these sites get shut down by law enforcement all the time. Every time you kind of enter your details to purchase something from one of those accounts. I guess now you have payment in Bitcoin, which makes it a little bit more anonymous. But thinking back to the good old days of cybercrime, you might have had to put your actual details in to be able to buy stuff, which gives law enforcement, if they're seizing the servers, a whole database of other criminals to go after. So yeah, ransomware is definitely the more lucrative and potentially more anonymous way to go about making money.
I guess so.
Would that be your cyber criminal path as well, Kim?
What, ransomware? No, yeah. I think I like to be like a really sophisticated Trojan coder.
Nice.
You know, one of those really high level guys and never getting caught.
Okay. No, I would like to be caught. Yeah. If I was cyber criminal, I would just do it to be caught. Actually, if I can change my answer, I would change but if I could,
I would do it anyway.
I would change. Like, I wouldn't want to be like a ransomware operator or an affiliate, but more like a super skilled social engineer person, like the one that can really do the tricks, like sort of lapses, but without being a kid and without all those obstacles. So good. But yeah, that's the kind of stuff that I would do.
I don't think I've put much thought to this before. I have no idea what I would be in the world of cyber criminality. I haven't got a clue.
Tune in next time for Chris's answer.
when he grows an imagination, you know. Awesome. Thanks very much. That was a really interesting discussion on carding. Not something we cover very often, is it, carding? Yeah. You know, we always talk about ransomware, but carding kind of gets pushed into the grass a little. So we'll move on to the last topic of discussion today, and that's on account takeover. So we've recently released our research report on account takeover in 2022, which was led by the Photon Threat Research team. We're all really happy it's finally been published. In many ways, because we've been writing about this for quite a long time now. Really, really great to finally get it published. And you can definitely check that out on our website. And essentially, account takeover is commonly referred to as ATO. And at a high level, it refers to the compromise of your online accounts by a threat actor who obviously has harmful intent. And that could be your online social media accounts, it could be your work login, or even your banking portal as well. And essentially, the report detailed the entire ATO lifecycle, starting with the initial identification of susceptible accounts or services, the acquisition of these accounts by various means, so usually social engineering, information stealing, malware, or indeed just purchasing or renting off other actors. They then move to verify these accounts across multiple services by using a credential stuffing tool or verifying the accounts that have a hash password by kind of using a password cracking tool before actually allowing the actors to exploit the accounts for whatever purposes he sees fit. And obviously, account takeover is very much related to the likes of carding, because that's essentially what it is in a form. So long and short, we documented the problem of ATO, you know, how it works, and what are the factors influencing it, and obviously how to remain safe as an individual or an organization as well. So I thought I'd ask you both the questions, your thoughts on ATO, and, you know, why do you think it continues to be a problem?
Well, I think because of, so yeah, as you said, ATO is basically finding combinations of username or email and passwords. And I think the main reason why ATO continues to be a problem is because of passwords and the fact that it's a technology that has been created years ago and that we keep using, but it's not that secure, or at least not as much as we like to think, especially when the common internet user does not put that much thought or attention into their passwords, which on one side makes sense. Like if I have to put in their shoes, and like we work in this sector, so we know how important this is and we know all the steps that we got to take. We can talk about that later, but a normal internet user doesn't care that much about it, just want to get their accounts done and do what they were meant to do with that account. So they would just reuse all the passwords or use, you know, easy one, like the name of the dog with 123 or whatever that is. And I get that. Like, I don't feel in the position of saying, oh, you're making a huge mistake. You are making a mistake from our point of view and from the technology point of view, but it is sort of normal to make those mistakes. And that's why ATO continues to be a problem, because we can keep saying how many times we want, yeah, use complex passwords, use a password manager. But my father, who's 65 years old, will not care that much about his, I don't know, poker account, you know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think that's the reason why this will be a problem.
Yeah, we can't criticize people too much, because it is that kind of usability over security factor.
And yeah, definitely.
You know, if you're constantly dossing yourself out of your accounts because you've forgotten the 20th password that you've set with, you know, so many different characters and special characters and all the rest of it, I get it. I get why users will just use the same thing. But it is a risk, and particularly that risk where you use that account, that password, and that username, which is obviously usually an email, across multiple services, because if it gets breached once, threat actors absolutely can identify other services where you use it that might be more risky.
Yeah.
In a relatively short space of time. And even with passwords as well, you know, if you have a hash password and it gets, you know, breached, they can crack it, you know, pretty easily if they have, you know, a number of, you know, useful techniques using kind of offline cracking techniques. So I absolutely get why people reuse passwords, but there is an easy way of managing this, or there's lots of different ways to mitigate this risk. But, you know, one of the big ones is, you mentioned, it's using password managers. You know, you can kind of store all your passwords in a really easy single place that's, you know, managed by a single master password, so make that really, really strong. But you can just keep the rest of them in there, essentially. And it provides you with auditing of those passwords as well, gives you recommendations on the strength and all the rest of it. So it's just the easiest place to do it, really. But you were saying about, you know, incidents that have happened as a result of like weak passwords. And you just, off the top of your head, you know, what were the worst incidents of the last 12 to 18 months? Like Clonal Pipeline, SolarWinds, that ransomware video I sent you earlier of the poor guy whose business went down. If you haven't watched it, for those who are listening, the Wall Street Journal did a really interesting interview with a chap who was, I think he was a CEO or a director of an industrial company who'd been targeted by a ransomware attack in 2019. And unfortunately, the backups they had at this company were not tested properly, so they didn't work. They actually paid the ransomware group to recover their files, and then they got targeted by another group. And they didn't have any instant response, didn't have any insurance, and unfortunately, this company folded, which I think is quite common. Yeah. I think there's I can't remember the percentage, but there's a really high percentage of companies that are targeted in ransomware attacks. They actually end up folding. So, massive problem. And this all came from one of his IT admins who had, you know, high privileges, using a password that was named after the location of the business.
Yeah. So that's what annoys me. You see, like the difference is there. So when security professionals make those mistakes,
that's unforgivable.
It's like you should know about that, and you should really put in the effort to come up with like good passwords. If someone cracks my father's poker account, like I would be like, okay, well, you've done it yourself, right? It's fine, whatever. As long as it's not your bank account. So that's the other thing, you know, if for the average internet user, if you can't care all your password that much, at least take care of the important ones, which is your bank account, everything that's got like really important and sensitive personal identifiable information, like all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, everyone has hundreds of accounts, and we've all been on the internet for so long that right now we've all lost track of that, right?
I mean, like banking portals, I think are quite good at providing those sufficient controls, like having MFA.
Yeah.
If my banking portal didn't have MFA, I'd probably be asking questions why.
Definitely.
But any thoughts from you on this one, Kim? You know, why do users keep, you know, continue with these risky practices?
I think you've kind of covered why users keep indulging in risky practices. I think what you were saying with the administrator coming up with the wrong password comes to another mitigation point of making sure that people in your business don't have permissions beyond what is necessary for their role. So have, you know, auditing permissions frequently, auditing accounts when people leave organizations or move into different roles. You know, keeping on top of that means that should the worst happen that you get breached, then that account can only access as much as it needs to. You know, sometimes that's going to mean that they get the top administrator and they get everything, but largely you would hope that users who are making those simple mistakes are not going to have all of the keys to the castle. That example you gave was just a very unfortunate incident. And then the only other thing I was going to add is that the reason account takeover keeps happening is because it's so easy, but also because there's still a real high demand for it, like with carding. Cyber criminals still just want your personal details, and phishing, even though everyone knows about it, everyone still falls victim to it, and it's still one of the most popular methods for gaining initial access to a system. So that ease of conducting it, coupled with the value that it can bring, just creates a recipe for disaster.
Absolutely. And if we could name the podcast, that would definitely be what I would call it, a recipe for disaster. Oh, you know what? I should have named the paper that.
Yeah.
Be better, wouldn't it?
Next one.
There we go. When do we do it in a couple of years again? I'm sure.
About that, I've got a question for you.
Okay.
Like, you are the person that worked the most on this paper. And so what is the most interesting finding that you got from researching and writing this paper? Something that maybe you already know about, but you went a little bit more deep and you found something that
I think like the speed in which passwords can be cracked was quite shocking. So we did an example on the paper of like the top 50 most common passwords, and obviously they can be cracked in pretty much a second, less than a second, by an offline attack. But also adding special characters just makes such a difference to that sequence as well. But even that's not invulnerable either, and they can pretty much crack those within a matter of an hour or so as well. So it was surprising to see, even if you have an encrypted password using a hashing method and it gets breached, it can still be cracked relatively easy by a skilled actor. So that was kind of surprising. And then I think the Verizon DBR that came out recently identified that stolen accounts were essentially used as the initial access vector in over 50% of incidents that they analyzed. So I think they analyzed like 20,000 incidents or something. So it's a subset, you know, it's not every single incident, but in the ones that they analyzed, it was 50%, which I thought was really quite shocking. I thought it would be much lower than that. You know, kind of assumed like phishing, social engineering, malware would be a higher percentage of that, like vulnerability exploitation. But like 50% is shocking. Like you say, all of the incidents we just reeled off the top of our head there, you know, they're a perfect classic example of that, you know, of how it can go wrong. I mean, SolarWinds, they called that, what was it, the most sophisticated attack of all time?
Yeah.
And there was what did they say? It was an intern's
yeah.
password that the CEO came and threw them under a bus. That was awful. But still, you know, that all started or in some fashion. I don't think the details came out exactly on it, but in some fashion that was influenced by a breach password, a breach weak password. So yeah, there's a couple of things that I thought were quite interesting, but definitely go check out the report. It really did take myself and the rest of the team a lot of time and effort, but really, 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 really pleased with what we put together. So definitely go and check that one out. So we'll call it a close there. I really want to take this time to just thank Stefano and Kim for joining me today. Really been great speaking to you as always.
Yeah, really enjoyed that.
And we do have a couple of blogs going out this week. The first being the monthly roundup of vulnerabilities. And we also have a blog on credential stuffing, funny enough, because that's the only thing I've wrote about in the last 2 months, it seems. But that's also related to the ATO piece we were just discussing. But that's it for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay safe and we'll see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.